You probably know the hits. Hits?
Those guys?
You probably know the hits.
Wait, this is, it has been about a month. What artist are we talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Hey, guys. This is Jason. That's Jeremy. Welcome to
Hey there.
You probably know the hits.
That's right.
We are covering Tom Petty for the third time. In particular, today we are focusing on Wildflowers, his solo record from the early 90s, right? 93, 94?
Yeah. You know what? That is what we're going to do now that you say that. I came in prepared to speak for about 3 hours on my new favorite band, Goose. You know, they're kind of a jam band, and now I'm jam band guy. That's all I care about is jam bands.
Okay.
I stopped wearing deodorant. I have a lot of tie-dyed shirts. I go barefoot everywhere. It's pretty much my entire personality now, and okay. I found him about 24 hours ago.
Okay.
But I'll pivot.
So to my other favorite artist. So you've been able to listen to like 3 or 4 tracks in that time. Is that fair?
Yeah, just their Live in San Diego bootleg.
Yeah, just that. That's like that in particular is like a 22-hour.
Yeah, they're at the intermission right now, so that's why I have a break. I have a break to do this. So
fish, huh?
Yeah. Dude, love me some fish. Farmhouse, great song. Farmhouse is that's good stuff. Even
you
though
know, I mean,
nothing like the rest
Taylor
of their
Swift
stuff.
Concerts are probably a gateway drug, and now it's kind of. I can't say I'm surprised by this development.
Yeah, at this point, I'll admit it's out of control. There's nothing you or anyone else can do about it until I hit rock bottom. And where is that? I don't know. Is it a Justin Timberlake show?
Maybe. It really seems like it's close with this jam band shit, but maybe that's wishful thinking.
I know we're getting there. Yeah. I know we are. So anyway, Tom Petty. Let's talk about Tom Petty.
Yeah.
And so we talked, yeah, we had 2 episodes. We talked about his kind of humble beginnings, growing up in Gainesville, Southern kid, rough relationship with his dad. Mom was kind of a nice lady, typical rock and roll story, really.
Right.
Gets together with his friends. They form the Heartbreakers. They have some hits in the late 70s through the 80s. We got to the late 80s, and he decided to make a solo record called Full Moon Fever, which, important to remember, his record label initially rejected. They did not like it.
Right. And this was one of the ones that when they actually did put it out, it was like huge. It was like
it changed his life, and he was already very wealthy and very famous.
Right.
And Full Moon Fever put him on a whole other level.
Was that the one you mentioned where it was like suddenly he was buying mansions?
But
the band was.
Yeah. One of the times. So he probably upgraded after Full Moon Fever, but he did, because his house burned down right before that. But okay. Damn the Torpedoes was the one that really changed their lives in the late 70s. And then Full Moon Fever just sent him to a whole nother level with lots of big hits. That was produced by Jeff Lynne. Petty forms with George Harrison, the Traveling Wilburys. Has a lot of fun with some of his musical heroes. At this point, he's become friends with George Harrison, which sounds like that was never lost on him for his entire life, that he was friends with George Harrison.
Yeah, that's a top 10 life accomplishment, I got to imagine.
That's just something I'm sure he would go to bed at night.
I saw in the Wildflowers documentary you mentioned, that you mentioned for me to watch, that we'll link in the podcast notes here, that he had Ringo drumming on one of the B-sides that ultimately didn't make the cut or whatnot. And it's like, you know what? I still don't think that's as cool as befriending George Harrison, you know?
I think if you're laying in bed at night, then you have to like wake up to go to the bathroom. And sometimes, you know, your mind just goes to places in your life that are
amazing,
extraordinary, or hard to believe. And that's one of those things. You'd wake up in the middle of the night and you would just be like, holy shit, I'm friends with George Harrison. What? Like that, that has to go through your mind once a day,
right?
At least.
Definitely.
So he does that, and then he makes another record with the Heartbreakers, produced by Jeff Lynne, called
Into the Great of ELO fame.
Of ELO fame.
Okay.
The End of the Great Wide Open wasn't their biggest album, but it did have a couple of big hits. Did a music video with Johnny Depp for the song Into the Great Wide Open. At this point, Petty and his wife had had a volatile relationship for a very long time. He had also had a volatile relationship with his record label for quite a while.
Noticing a pattern here, maybe.
There are some things in his life that are about to dramatically change kind of all at once. And it causes him eventually to go into a pretty deep depression, caused him some real problems through the late 90s before he came out of it. And we'll talk about that probably next episode, but
sure.
That's kind of where we left. We left it, I think, with some issues over his record label. So MCA is who he'd been with basically since the beginning.
Okay. And like you mentioned, there was several record instances where they would push back on him, be like, we're not releasing this, or, you know, go back to the studio or something, and just whatever. Not full support.
Not full support. There were a couple of issues there. One was they didn't like Full Moon Fever. That really pissed him off. Another one that I kind of brushed up on the book Petty by Warren Zanes, who is a fantastic writer, and it's one of the best rock biographies I've ever read. Written with Petty's participation, but without his influence. In other words, Zanes had permission to print whatever he wanted.
Right.
But Petty did interview for the book along with everyone else that you'd want to hear from. So in that, he also tells a story about how Petty got invited to do SNL right after Full Moon Fever came out. And with the big hit at the time on Full Moon Fever was I Won't Back Down.
Okay.
Petty didn't like the way I Won't Back Down was shaping up live. It just, they hadn't gotten the sound down yet. So he decided to play two different songs on SNL instead of the one, you know, real big hit at the time.
So the single he was supposed to be pushing was I Won't Back Down.
And the problem is the record label, I guess SNL doesn't really pay musical guests. I've heard that before. They don't really pay them.
They pay you in exposure. Isn't that how all the arts work?
Yeah. All for exposure, right? Yeah. On SNL, maybe that's true. But they also mean artists have to pay their own way to get, like, so the record label told Petty, hey, if you go do SNL, we'll pay for it. We'll pay for you guys to go out there, you know, get your equipment out there, all that stuff.
Okay.
So Petty's like, all right.
Which probably means we'll put it on your tab, but we'll cover it for now.
Yeah. I'd like to see the actual bill. I'd like to see the credit card receipt for who actually paid for it in the end. But so they go out there, they do these two other songs. Well, the record label guy, the president of the record label, tells Petty's manager that he's pissed that Petty didn't play I Won't Back Down. And the manager's like, well, he's Tom. He kind of does what he wants.
Right.
And so the manager said, yeah, I made the mistake of telling Tom about that conversation. Oh, he said, yeah. I told Tom that the record label guy was really mad that he didn't play Won't Back Down. And Tom goes, what's his phone number? I'm going to call him right now. And the manager is like, no, you don't need to call him. It's fine. He was like, no, what's his phone number? I'm calling him right now. And the manager's like, the manager's name is Tony. And Tony's like, Tom, I'm not giving you his phone number. And he said, Tom hung up. Tony immediately calls their office, like his secretary.
Yeah, beware, and it's like, Tom's going to find your like, number if for Tom the next calls, 5 minutes if, somehow.
Yeah, she's like, if Tom calls, do not give him that guy's phone number. And she goes, oh, he just called.
Man.
So he said, yeah, Tom called the president and was like, fuck you. And the president then calls Tom's manager, and they're now into it again, and it's just a mess. Which is amazing to me that they feel like they, and I don't mean this as a pun, it feels like the record label is willing to let a lot of pettiness get in the way of nice their relationship with this man.
Yeah.
All right. Pun intended. I own it. I don't care.
No, and again, this is during the Full Moon Fever era, or this is during the Great Wide Open?
Full Moon Fever into the Great Wide Open during that time frame.
Okay.
Because they're only a couple years apart.
At this point, he's several records into this deal, has made the company millions and millions of dollars.
And they're bitching about the song he plays on SNL.
Man.
And so Petty is friends with George Harrison. George Harrison is on Warner Brothers Records. And Petty really liked Warner Brothers the way they treated George Harrison, because George Harrison had always told Petty how he was really grateful. Like, he made an album in the late 70s, early 80s, and then he just kind of disappeared until the late 80s. He didn't do anything throughout the mid-1980s. Like, no records. And he said that Warner Brothers never pressured him. They never asked him when the next record was coming. They just left him alone until he was ready to give them a record. And Petty had never experienced anything like that before with his label. And so he always liked Warner Brothers. He happens to meet like a couple of Warner Brothers guys. They have dinner. His MCA deal has 2 years left on it. And Warner Brothers signs him to a contract that will go into effect when his MCA deal is up.
2 years or two albums or...
2 years.
That's weird.
2 years, but he owed them another album within those 2 years.
Oh, interesting.
So
words, is it sort of like if the album's not done, then 2 years it'll expire anyway? Or
no, in 2 years he won't be released from that contract until he delivers that last album.
Man,
so he owes like that, them another album.
Call it those no compete things where it's like even if you deliver that to us tomorrow, the next 2 years you know. You
correct.
Sit on your hands, or we correct. Own whatever you make. Right.
So Petty does this. He didn't even consult his manager. He just does it, and it was a good move. Like I don't want to say it wasn't. It ended up being a very good move for him, and he was happy with Warner Brothers for a very long time. He finally calls his manager, tells him what he did, and word eventually kind of gets around the industry, and gets finally to the president of MCA, and that guy is furious and is like, okay, well, you owe me an album. Petty is just like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do another album.
Right.
I'm not into it anymore. I don't like MCA. I don't like their influence. I don't want to make another album for MCA. So sure. He does what Tom Petty does and just kind of does whatever he wants. Right.
Right. Right.
So they basically come to an agreement that he'll put out a greatest hits album as long as he produces two new songs to put on that album.
This is common, right? Like Perfect Circle had like a 4-record deal and like on the same day put out like a record of covers and a record of like greatest hits / remixes, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Rage Against the Machine, I'm pretty sure that awesome covers record they had at the end was, you know, to basically fulfill the record contract and get it done with, right?
Well, and why was Load and Reload 2 albums instead of 1 double album?
Oh, interesting. Was that same situation? They actually were trying to get out of that particular deal so they could get another one or a new company? Okay.
I don't know if they were trying to get out of it, but they were certainly trying to get 1 album closer to being done with it.
Right.
And I think I've heard Lars say, yes, they put out 2 separate albums instead of a double album because 2 separate albums counts as 2 albums and a double album does not.
God, can you fucking imagine like your whole artistic vision just being like, well, I'm in this stupid fucking contract.
Yeah.
You know, like, man.
Yeah, and Petty really hated those games. He just hated that side of it so much. So all this is happening. He's coming to an agreement to get out of his deal with MCA. He's going to go to Warner Brothers. He has some new songs brewing in his head. He thinks it's going to be more of an acoustically, kind of more of a laid back, more of a solemn album.
Sure.
And now, in the background, cut to another scene, here's Rick Rubin, producer extraordinaire. Rick Rubin, the genius Rick Rubin, former hip-hop producer, produced Tom Petty, produced Metallica, has produced everybody. And he is known to be the guy you go to when you want to make like your greatest album, basically.
Right.
Did I describe Rick Rubin as you would describe Rick Rubin?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair. The thing is, at that point, he definitely was not the paragon that he is now, right?
But I would agree.
He was huge for sure. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, like, I guess his fame and notoriety has grown and grown and grown consistently for, like, literally decades. So the Rick Rubin we know over the last, like, I don't know, decade is just, you know, a god among men compared to this one we're talking about here. You know, in particular, because in that documentary was talking about Tom working with him, Rick mentioned something like that he kind of asked about it and got an immediate no, you know, and that when Tom did start. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Perfect. All right. Okay. And 3, 2, 1. Okay, we are back. I had a slight microphone problem because I don't have Rick Rubin as a producer. Nothing works around here. So anyway, let's pick it up where we left off, huh?
But yeah, in that documentary, it said that Rick even was kind of like, and I wouldn't say begging, but he like basically asked, hey, I'd like to work with Tom Petty. And it was like, no, Tom Petty works with Jeff Lynne, you know?
Yeah.
And it sounded like, and I'm not sure, you know, if I was listening correctly, but it sounded like Wildfires kind of like evolved. Like he basically did a few songs with Ruben and then later kind of came back, did a few more songs in some other session or something. I'm sure you'll get into this.
Yeah,
but it was still like even when he was actually working with Rick Rubin, there was like not even a handshake deal that Rubin was making an album with him. It was just kind of a collaboration kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it started out that way. I mean, I think what happened was Rick Rubin, he loved Full Moon Fever. And he has said several times that like that is like his favorite album ever. And at the time, it certainly was his favorite album. He said that over and over again, like that is his favorite album ever. And he listened to it. Oh, he said he literally said the documentary, like, he said, I think literally like 10,000 times. Like I've listened to it over and over and over and over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so he does what you said. He gets in touch with MCA, and MCA's like, no, Petty works with Jeff Lynne. So he's like, oh, all right. But then Rick Rubin, somehow he does some work with Mike Campbell, and Mike Campbell kind of brokered between the two. He introduced them. And they talked because Petty really wanted to, I think, get away from like the Jeff Lynne sound that had kind of dominated those previous albums. And there is a distinct sound with Jeff Lynne. It's very perfectionist.
Right.
It's done in layers. You know, they'll go do the drums, then they'll record the guitar. Nothing is done live. And the band really hated that. The band really, really disliked working with Jeff Lynne in a pretty big way, it sounds like.
Huh.
They all like him as a person. They love his music. They hated being produced by him.
Yeah.
So, Petty and Rick Rubin, it sounds like, just kind of hit it off. And what's funny about it is that Rick Rubin didn't, and this is in the documentary, he came with no technical skill. He knows nothing about music. He doesn't play any instrument. Like, he doesn't do any of the things that you would expect a producer to do.
You know, I mean, I've heard, so he did a couple of songs, or maybe one song for the Pumpkins for the Adore album, that, like, Billy Corgan wound up leaving off the album because the record company was saying, this is going to be our single, no matter what. He's like, good luck with that. I didn't even put it on the album then, you know? but what I heard in that case, and I'm sure there's others we've talked about who, you know, Rubin has at least worked with, was like that Rubin was more like, he's like a good decision maker. Like, this is good. That's not good. This is great. That needs to be worked like this. Like, just real snap, quick, whatnot, rather than like a maestro on the dials, you know, at the console. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. We talked about this in the Metallica episode.
Whereas Jeff Lynne is a technology wizard. Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
And a musical genius.
Right.
But Rick Rubin calls the balls and strikes.
Yeah. He's literally like a tastemaker. That's what he is.
He said his greatest asset is his taste. It's his single greatest asset. Which,
for anybody else in the world, you can't help but laugh and be like, that is the most pretentious bullshit I've ever heard in my life. But then you're like, oh, wait, Rick Rubin? Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
But we talked about the same thing with Metallica. Metallica, basically, all he did was they played him a bunch of songs, and he would just be like, not that one. Yes, that one. No, not that one. like he told them to come in with the songs finished, and they played songs, and he would just like, yes or no. Well, what he did.
That gem right there, that's your favorite one, that's a B-side. Just like that. Damn.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah. That's ironic you say that, because this album is going to end up with a lot of songs that kind of suffered that type of fate.
Huh.
A lot of really great songs that suffered that type of fate, for a couple of reasons. So Petty, he works out the deal with MCA, and then he goes and starts making Wildflowers. He chooses to make it as a solo album. He wanted to just make a record with he and Rick Rubin without having to have the Heartbreakers input. Same thing he did with like Full Moon Fever.
And this was the second time that happened, correct?
Yes.
Like, yeah, not that so with this guy, but second time he'd done a solo record, just kind of break away from the, I think in the documentary he mentions sort of the democracy of it.
Yeah.
Everybody having input on every little thing. kind of issues.
He just wanted to make the decisions with he and his producer and that be it.
Right.
This really caused a lot of problems with the Heartbreakers. Once again, they did not like this. They kind of talk about it a little bit in the documentary. They talk about it a lot more in the book, about just kind of feeling left out of the process. And then he would still just call them in. Like, he still didn't use other musicians. When he needed a guitar part, he would still call Mike Campbell to come in and play a guitar part. Ben Montench, like, he really complains about this, about how, you know, yeah, he'd call me in, but it would just be like, play this chord. It'd be like something anybody could do. Right. You know, it wouldn't be, I'm not making up my own part. They're just telling me, go ding, 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 ding. So I go ding, 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 ding. Yeah. And that's it.
Whereas otherwise it's been collaborative. It's been like, yeah, I'm not telling you how to play the drums, right?
Right. So one guy who's really perturbed by this is Stan Lynch, the drummer.
Okay.
He really is I think more hurt by this than the other guys. Why that is, I don't know. Stan was, he always seemed to take things more personally than everyone else. And so in this case, he wasn't really being used at all.
Right.
I do think they were using another drummer by then. They brought in Steve Ferroni to do those sessions. So he was truly left out in ways that the other guys weren't.
Huh.
And also, apparently, word was getting back to Tom that Stan didn't think the songs were that good. And not the best move.
Yeah.
Not the best move. So he's kind of persona non grata at this point. Tom starts putting these songs down, and one thing that's apparent immediately in the documentary called Somewhere You Feel Free, it's on YouTube, and it's free, and it's incredible. A lot of footage of the making of this record, stuff as a huge Petty fan I had never seen before.
Yeah, that they basically found in the, you know, after his death, 2017, right?
Yeah.
This thing came out in 2020. I mean, it's recent. This is not like a 1970s, TV show special. It's really well done.
Yeah, it really is. So in the documentary, it comes apparent really early on that these lyrics that he's writing are like really kind of dark and apparently very personal. And it starts with the very first song on the record, Wildflowers. You belong among the wildflowers. You belong somewhere. You belong somewhere. You feel free. Go away. Go find a lover. Let your heart be your guide. Like, he is writing songs that appear to be about wanting to kind of break free or wanting to end something.
Right.
And in particular, he says about the song Wildflowers, he says in his book that he played that song for his therapist, and his therapist said, well, who is that about? And Tom said, I don't know. I don't know. They're just words. And the therapist said, no, I think you're writing that song about yourself, and you're telling yourself something that you've needed to hear for a long time. And what that was his marriage was over. He knew it. No one else knew it yet, but he knew that it couldn't continue. It had become apparent that his wife had some real mental health issues. She was at that time a pretty heavy drug user, an alcoholic, it sounded like, and he just knew, like, it couldn't go on. It had to end. And he had two, you know, teenage girls, and I think he was just really agonizing over this. The whole album is about that. I mean, it's basically about that very situation.
Yeah.
And it's very solemn. It's very dark. That's kind of the mood of the whole documentary. Didn't you find, like, the whole documentary has kind of a very somber mood to it?
Definitely. And, like, there's more than a few places where the daughter, who I think is probably one of the people that orchestrated kind of getting this thing all together,
mm-hmm.
you know, mentions. She was like, even when it was happening, it was, or, you know, when it came out, I guess, or I'm not sure. You know, she mentioned, like, that it was pretty obvious this is his, you know, kind of, not necessarily love letter to them, but like a note to them of like, hey, you know, this is, you know, mom and me are over kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, like that was, at least that was maybe how she took it and how it affected her.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, definitely a somberness. It was interesting because I've seen some other footage in general, and he does seem to be generally like an upbeat and kind of slightly silly kind of guy, you know, very humorous. And,
yeah.
You know, just easygoing. And Yeah, it seemed like, you know, the relationship thing we've obviously, you and I have talked about a lot offline, but, you know, not just the relationship thing. It sounded like the record deal thing was wearing on him quite a bit, too. And like you said, definitely just a somberness in the air, especially for sure. him, I think. Yeah,
yeah. I think it's fair. I think so. And you know, the record label thing is interesting because that's what we'll kind of talk about now is while he's making these like deeply personal kind of sad songs that are going to turn out to be a masterpiece of an album, like it's time to turn in the greatest hits record to MCA for that to be over with.
Right.
And he needs two new songs. So Petty gets Rick Rubin and he gets the Heartbreakers and they go to like another studio and they set up a whole new operation. Like they take a break from Wildflowers. They go to another studio just so they can record three or four songs to find one that's suitable to go on this. They're just trying to write some throwaway stuff to put on this greatest hits record to be done with this thing.
Right.
And in these sessions, in the middle of Wildflowers, Tom Petty writes Mary Jane's Last Dance. Which
when you listen to that, literally that greatest hits record, I have it.
Yeah.
Right. And it was before you told me about all this Wildflower stuff a few years back. That was what I would listen to. And I'd be like, oh yeah, Mary Jane's Last Dance. That's one of his biggest hits too. Yeah. That's
yes.
I had no idea it was made for that specific.
You just assume it's one of the hits.
Right. Like you... yeah. You're like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Wow. So like, and what was the other song? Was it one that's, because I mean, obviously I've heard it on the greatest hits, but it was also
yeah,
huge?
Yeah, it was a cover of a Thunderclap Newman song. Next episode, by the way, Thunderclap Newman. We're going to do probably a four-parter on that one.
Okay.
Something in the Air.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
A good song. I like Thunderclap Newman's version. I love Petty's version. They would do it live sometimes. It's a good song, but those were the two. Those are the two new songs.
Okay, damn. And so, and Mary Jane's Last Dance presumably sells this greatest hits record pretty well.
I think I read 12 million.
Holy shit! Is that more than the other records had sold?
I don't know. I would bet it's up there with like Damn the Torpedoes.
Right, and I mean, obviously they're getting a cut, right?
But, that was the first Petty album I owned.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a great fucking Petty album. I mean, the dude has, you know, I think all the records to me sound similar-ish. I think that you've listened to them more critically and can tell some different phases in their career. I mean, if out of a band to have a greatest hits record, you know, Creedence is the one that surprised me. We were like, yeah, they had like three records that had that double record worth of songs on it. It's like you basically just paid for one less record by getting this greatest hits set. You know, the Petty one is like a definitely one of the best greatest hits collections I've ever owned. Owned a ton of them, but I mean, you know, it's two or three songs per record that are every single one of them, you know, all the words to.
It is banger after banger after banger.
Yeah.
And you listen to them and you're like, man, on, you know, growing up on classic rock radio, I heard every one of those songs in pretty heavy rotation.
Right.
Like there was a time as a teenager when I didn't care for Tom Petty because like some of those songs were so overplayed on the radio. I just didn't care about them anymore. And you know, that obviously changed for me a little bit after that, but
sure.
I mean, those songs were heavy, heavy rotation songs.
Right.
And so the greatest hits record, I mean, this, his parting gift to MCA is a
$12
million selling
like,
album.
And in particular, MCA had to pay almost nothing to get it. Like no
that's
studio
what I was gonna
fees
say.
For
it,
16 tracks.
That's right. Yeah.
Time.
It cost nothing to produce. They just threw some songs together and Petty pulls a huge hit out of his ass during these sessions just to get a couple of throwaway songs on this record.
God, isn't that the way?
That's incredible.
And 1979 is Pumpkin's biggest one, right? And it was the same thing. They literally, like, at the last minute were like, you know, if you want this one on the record, just finish it. And because of that, because of not having the pressure for weeks and weeks to try and get it done, it just came out how it did. And biggest song, like out of all the songs they've spent those weeks and weeks on and perfected, you know, maniacally for, you know, tens and twenties of hours per track.
Yep.
Doesn't matter, you know.
I know. Well, One interesting thing about these sessions, by the way, this is interesting to me. If you watch the music video for Mary Jane's Last Dance.
Okay. Is that the one where he's like Alice in Wonderland?
No, that's okay. Don't Come Around Here No More.
Okay.
If you watch the music video, I think there's two videos for it. If you watch the one that's like basically the camera's in the middle and it's just panning around to all of the band playing the song.
Okay.
That is shot in Mike Campbell's living room.
Interesting. Okay.
Like that's his house. He still lives there today.
This is how half-assed this was.
Yeah. This is just so thrown together.
Right.
That is so. Stan Lynch was not playing on Wildflowers at all. In fact, he and Tom were really in a bad way at this point. They were not getting along at all. In fact, during the Wildflower sessions, there were two people not allowed in the studio. One was Tom's wife, Jane, and the other was Stan Lynch.
Damn,
okay. Like, just keep out. And Petty, and I mean, Rick Rubin said it was apparent that he didn't really want to go home. Like, Petty preferred to be at the studio during this time. Like, he clearly was trying to avoid going home. But for these other songs, the non-Wildflower songs that they need to put on the Greatest Hits record, that's going to be a Heartbreakers thing. So they bring Stan Lynch back. Huh. And when you see him drumming in that video, that is the last thing he ever did with the Heartbreakers.
Interesting. Okay.
He played it. The sessions, he said, were very difficult because he didn't have any advanced copy of the song or anything. He just had to come in like day of and make up the part and get it right. And he's like, that's what everyone expects, that you're just going to nail it on like the first try. And it's very stressful. But he did. Like on that song, he absolutely nailed it. And it's, I think, considered by Petty fans as one of his best performances.
Huh.
And we'll get to his firing here in a minute.
Sure.
But so they go do those things. MCA makes money hand over fist. And again, they already
have at least scratch versions of maybe half or better, or at least, you know, a handful of tracks for Wildflowers in the can. Now, is this similar? Run me back. Wasn't there a situation where, like, Tom didn't know about some recordings for a previous album so that the record company couldn't come get it from them until they struck some kind of deal?
He's done it before where he was literally, like, taking the master tapes.
Right. Now, is this the same situation? Does MCA know this stuff is being recorded at all?
I don't know if they know, but I don't think it would. I don't know that that would have been in violation of his contract. He just wouldn't have been able to put it out until his contract was up.
Okay.
Because if he's paying for studio time out of his own pocket, then, you know.
Oh, okay.
I don't think they could control that.
Right.
So now they go back to the Wildflower sessions, and they are putting down song after song after song to the point where they have a collection of like 30 songs that they've put down. And it is a like massive chore just to sort out like what's what.
Right.
I saw on the movie today, you saw the producer. Not the producer, but like the studio manager who had the big chart, the big whiteboard.
Yeah.
That was like, this is that we had to keep track of all the songs. And like, there were different marks for like backing track done, track finished, what, you know, there's all these different steps that they had to go through just to keep track of where they were on everything.
Right. Yeah. And in particular, there was some, I think it was a soundbite from Rick Rubin. It might've been from Mike Campbell that the, you know, Jeff Lynne wasn't there being perfectionist, but Tom wanted every single track to be the best it ever done. So they work on track number one and it's super great. And track number two needs to be better than track number one was that they're working on, you know?
Yep.
So it sounds like maybe Jeff was there in spirit. Is that a fair statement? Or
I think Mike Campbell said that like this is, they took what they learned from Jeff Lynne and they were kind of set free to use it
right
on this record with Rick Rubin. They were able to kind of use what they learned from Jeff, but do it in their own way. And so I think the influence is undeniable for the rest of their career. I think they were heavily influenced by Jeff Lynne.
Right.
So they've got all these songs. I want to go through a couple of these songs just so we get a real sense of like where Tom's head was at this point.
Okay.
And I think this is one reason me and you love this song, because me and you love this album because we've both been through times in our lives where like some of these songs appear to be speaking directly to us.
Right.
or made up about us.
I mean, you mentioned it to me when I was going through my divorce, and it was an interesting, I mean, it really flipped my entire perspective on the guy, because some of the greatest hits songs, they sound like a little bit dismissive, I guess, or, you know, mm-hmm. borderline sort of abusive, you know, and you're like, man, this guy's like a rock star, who's a total dickhead. Like, is he talking about being on the road and, you know, telling people they're trash? You know, mm-hmm. one of them is like, you know, you'll, you know, basically never find anybody better than me, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, turns out you mentioned to me, told me like that a lot of stuff is, you know, retroactively sort of like, you know, autobiographical songs sort of in that particular instance, you know, about stuff that his, you know, ex-wife would, you know, throw at him, you know.
Right. Yeah,
really changed my perspective on him and, you know, what his story is, and like just kind of the it really that I don't know, I tend to take a lot of songs as sort of autobiographical as my first like instinct is like, oh, what is this person singing about in their life, right? I always think of it as from their perspective, and in particular, I don't know, Tom Petty has a real, you know, he has a real energy that what he's talking about is from his perspective. I can't explain why, he just does. That really changed my perspective on him in general. And I got to be honest, like Greatest Hits is all I had. Mm-hmm. And he told me about Wildflowers, and like, man, I went on several road trips where Wildflowers, you know, kicked it off, and yeah, it's a great introspective record. And I can't say personally like that there's particular tracks that really speak to me a ton, like these lyrics are, man, I get this, but I will submit that last song, help me with the title,
Crawling Back to You.
Yeah, Crawling Back to You is like a top five song of all time to me sonically.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, and it's a great concept, and it has that fucking great line of like, most of the things I worry about never happen anyway.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
But you know, and the actual concept of crawling back to somebody isn't something that I personally relate to, but it was man, that song is such a like perfectly produced and architected song.
And I think that's one of his favorite songs.
Yeah.
On his last tour, he was playing it some.
Okay.
Which is weird because it was certainly not a hit at all. I mean, that is a deep, deep, deep cut.
But really? Petty, but it wasn't on the radio? I feel like I had heard it before.
I had never heard it.
Really?
I don't think it was on the radio. Maybe satellite radio.
Huh. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong. It seemed like it was familiar, but maybe it's similar to some other one of his songs that was on the radio.
Yeah, I'd never heard it before I listened to this record all the way through.
Okay.
But it is definitely one of his favorite. He talked about that song as one that he really, really was proud of.
So, but yeah, I mean, you mentioned that there's some songs that, in particular are already kind of already in the can when we, started getting into this greatest hits and coming back from it.
Yeah.
So in particular, it sounds like several of them, I think that you've picked these apart, you know, maybe like I've picked apart Smashing Pumpkins songs in my life.
Sure.
I just never have with this particular guy.
So let's go through, I want to go through the track listing real quick. We're not going to talk about every single song,
but
there's a couple that I really want to hit on that really illustrate like really where he was and why his daughter said, like, when I heard this record, I knew they were getting divorced.
Is that how it happened? Like she didn't know? Like it wasn't like published after the divorce?
She said that when he would finish an album, they would go to their vacation home in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And which I suspect was pretty nice. And they would listen to the new record. And so they did this, and they listened to Wildflowers, and like every song she was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
No.
They're definitely divorcing. Like she knew. Just by listening to it.
Damn.
So yeah, the first song, Wildflowers, You Belong Among the Wildflowers, You Belong Where You Feel Free, Sail Away, Go Find a Lover. Go away, let your heart be your guide. Like that's the one that his therapist was like, yeah, you're telling yourself that,
right?
Like you're telling yourself something that you really need to hear.
Yeah.
The next one, You Don't Know How It Feels. This was a song that when they were kind of, I think when they were trying to figure out, like, what's the hit on this album? They couldn't figure it out. This was it. This ended up being, like, one of the big hits of his career.
Right.
One of the big hits of the album, You Don't Know How It Feels to Be Me. Great song. Like, that was one of the first songs their new drummer drummed on, Steve Ferroni. We'll talk about him here in a minute. The next one, Time to Move On, Time to Get Going. What lies ahead? I have no way of knowing, but under my feet, the grass is growing. I mean, can't get much more obvious than that.
Yeah, pretty on the nose. Yeah.
A couple of good rockin' songs. You Wreck Me. I don't know if there's anything to read into that one. It's Good to Be King. Really, really good song. He loved playing that one live.
Yeah.
Just kind of a real slow jam. Really, really great song. The next one, Only a Broken Heart. with the line, I'm not afraid anymore. It's only a broken heart.
Right.
Honeybee. Good video of Dave Grohl drumming to Honeybee online. You can find. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's a fun story. Dave Grohl and Tom Petty.
Okay. So is it safe to say this is perhaps a concept album? Might have a common theme kind of going through these songs, or maybe I'm reading into this a little bit. Is that?
Has it been called his divorce album? Yes. Yes, it has.
Okay.
It's the album of sadness.
Yeah.
But,
which is interesting because, I mean, it's not completely foreign, right? I mean, he has songs that are introspective and stuff, but yeah, this it's heavy all the way through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't Fade on Me is.
And it kind of gets you because that first one is a sweet song and you're kind of like, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a nice little record. And like it's, and what's weird about it is it came out in the 90s, right? When plenty of angry rock was around that was, you know, very heavy rock and whatnot. And this is still like classic Americana, you know, almost disarming. You know, in theme, almost every single song, and yet, it hits hard.
That, you know what? If this came out today and Tom Petty was not a known artist, this would be classified as Americana. This would be, along with like Jason Isbell and Tyler Childers and those types of bands.
Right.
Like that's what it sounds like, and that's what it would be today if it came out today by someone who was unknown.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Don't Fade on Me is just a haunting, sad, incredible song.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite on the album. It's so good. His guitar work is great on it. One of my favorites. Hard on Me. maybe if I tried, I could turn the other cheek, is a line in that song. Cabin Down Below. I don't know what that one's about. To Find a Friend, Ringo plays on this one. Ringo plays drums on To Find a Friend.
Okay, because it specifically called out, in the documentary it does mention some of the ones that got cut, and it specifically calls out one of them had Ringo on it. Are there several tracks he played on, or just these two?
That's the only one that I know of.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
Maybe I was mishearing there a little bit.
And I mean, maybe the info I got was wrong, too. Who knows? I found mine on the internet.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, I mean, mine was on YouTube from, you know, from a source that had Rick Rubin, the oracle of all truthful information on it. So I think
okay.
But I also
I got
wasn't
mine.
Listening,
I got
so that might
I got
be
I got I got mine from InfoWars.
Okay.
So, about the same.
Yeah, about the same pedigree. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. To Find a Friend has the line in the middle of his life, left his wife, ran off to be bad, everyone was mad.
Huh. I'm just sitting here thinking of this family that has not been discussed with, the kids. They're just all sitting in the living room, kind of bop on their head, and he's just sitting there, presumably like looking at the ceiling or out the window. Not at his kids' eyes, right?
Do you think his wife has given him the side eye?
This is nice, Tom. I like it. Oh, what's this one about?
Oh, man.
God. Tough time in the Petty household there in the vacation condo. You're going to see this place.
Are these songs about us, Tom? Are these songs about us?
Yeah.
What have you done, Tom? I don't know that that's how she talked, but she does now. Then we have a Higher Place, House in the Woods, really good jam. Crawling Back to You, as we talked about, one of the best songs on the record. And then the last song is Wake Up Time. Okay, so two things. Crawling Back to You has that line that you just mentioned that...
most of the things I worry about never happen anyway.
I'm so tired of being tired. Sure as night will follow day. Most things I worry about never happen anyway.
Right.
That line was originally in You Don't Know How It Feels.
Okay.
That was one of the verses in You Don't Know How It Feels. And he thought that line went better at the end of their album. And so we put it on Crawling Back to You.
Yeah.
Because he thought it went better back there.
Yeah, it's a line for the ages. Like, it's just one of those ones. I mean, I think about it all the time.
No,
you know, yeah, especially like when I'm giving myself anxiety for no goddamn reason. I'm like, man.
Yep.
You know,
I know it. If I ever got a tattoo with lyrics, it'd be that. I spend a lot of time thinking about that. I remind myself of it as though it came from like the Bible, but like more relevant. great song, beautiful line. And then Wake Up Time. Wake Up Time is interesting because so the new drummer that they had in these sessions was like on his way out the door. He had to get back to New York for another session that he was booked for. And they were like, hey, let's try this one more song, Wake Up Time. And he's like, I have time for like one or two takes. And like Tom is on piano. Tom is playing the piano on that song. And Tom is playing it. Steve Ferroni sits down. He just makes up the drum part. First round through, that's the take.
Damn.
One take, he nailed it. And so Wake Up Time is a good song. And Wake Up Time is more of a... Wake Up Time feels like you're coming out of it. Now things are looking up. This album ends on a kind of an optimistic note, I feel.
Yeah, definitely.
And that was it.
Right. Now, in the documentary, it mentions how, at least for a time, maybe they're considering it being a double album. Sounds like they got pushed back from a record company. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But has it ever been like released? Like, did they have a run order that was for the two albums? Or was it like way early on they were told, nope, it's going to be single CD. So it was just a process of cutting things out rather than.
So I don't know if they ever had the sequence down for both.
Right.
But they have released the ones that did not get released. That came out last year or 2 years ago, maybe now.
Right. It's called All the Rest. Right.
Right. And Petty had intended on doing that for years. Like he had for years talked about re-releasing Wildflowers with all the stuff that didn't get on Wildflowers.
And did he, when he mentioned it, did he intend for it to be cut inside? Like, you know, some bands have done that where it's like, okay, here's the remaster. You get a 7 CD set. A couple of CDs are, you know, you got the remaster that's like the original album sequence, and then a couple of CDs are the resequence with the stuff they wanted in the middle before the record company told them no, you know.
I don't know.
I guess we'll never know. It was kind of like this All the Rest thing was just sequenced by just family, you know.
I think Rick Rubin was a part of it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so... So they have all these songs. Petty and Rubin did want to put out a double album at first, and I've heard the other songs that ended up not making it, and it could have been a double album. Those songs are great. You could have swapped out a bunch of Wildflower songs for some of those, and it would have been just as good.
And it's really good. All that stuff is, completely the same. Thematically, and there's nothing that's this is a discard at all?
Nothing that stands out to me. I'd have to go back. It's been a while since I've listened to all the rest. Uh-huh. So I'd have to look at it again, but nothing that immediately comes to mind.
Huh.
They go to the record label. The record label, this new record label, Warner Brothers, doesn't tell them no, but it's like, we don't think that's a good idea. We think you should whittle it down to like the 10 best songs.
Right.
Make a really
They have a funny clip where Tom's in the studio. I think it might be around the time they got the news or whatever, where he's like, let's go do some research on double albums that did well, right? And there's like three of them in the history of man, right? I mean, and granted, you know, the wall has done pretty great, you know, but,
yep.
You know, and I guess by that time, Use Your Illusion was probably out, but I mean, yeah. It's...
But yeah, history is not kind to double albums usually.
Right. Well, it was going to be double CD too, right? Which is like really like a triple or quadruple album. If you talk about, you know, actual vinyls and whatnot, right?
Right.
The Wall is like a few minutes short of being able to all, or a few minutes long of being able to fit all on one CD, you know? So anyway.
So. The record label asked him to not do this, and Rick Rubin in the documentary said, like, I was really surprised Tom agreed. Like, he said, I kind of, you know, knowing Tom's reputation for standing up to record labels, he said, I thought he was going to protest.
Well, and at this point,
he didn't.
New record label? You said it was Warner Brothers, is that right?
Yep.
This is Warner Brothers. Very first, like, thing he might deliver on that, or is this a solo record, like, single deal contract?
No, this is his first delivery for that big new contract. Man,
giving him shit out the gate. I mean, I don't know. Like, I know. It is what it is. Like,
well, and that's why I say...
Double records do not sell, and especially fucking 1993, I mean, or four.
And that's why I say, I don't know that they flat out told him no. I think they just kind of asked him, could you make it a single album instead, maybe?
Are you sure about that?
There's an idea. I think that may have been kind of what happened.
Okay.
So they agree. The album comes out. It's a success right away. I think I saw in the first 6 months it sold 2 million copies.
Damn.
In the first 6 months. That's pretty good. Tom goes on a tour, and it's wildly successful. A couple of things happen during this time. So there is a live performance at Neil Young's Bridge School benefit in San Francisco.
Okay.
This is kind of while they're making Wildflowers.
Okay.
So Tom agrees to play, and they play like an acoustic set, but so they have drummers, but the drummer has, like, you know, brushes or something, you know. So Stan Lynch flies out for that.
Interesting.
And while he is there...
To be clear, is this a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers kind of set, or is it just a Tom Petty set?
Because no,
a lot of the Bridge School stuff... for a lot of other popular bands, has literally been like an acoustic breakdown of like two of the members or something.
No, this is a whole Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers band.
Okay.
They're just all playing acoustic instruments.
Okay.
And so Stan Lynch comes out for that. Tom said in his book, it is one of the only times he was ever embarrassed about a performance because Stan was so bad.
Oh,
like, he said he just wasn't into it. He didn't want to be there. He didn't want to do it. And he wasn't into it at all. And then he said somewhere backstage, someone asked Stan, like, what he's been up to or something. Stan basically made a comment that, like, yeah, the Heartbreakers aren't really my main thing right now.
Oh, tell us more, Stan.
do you think Stan Lynch would like a do-over on saying that? I mean,
I hate to jump ahead, but does Stan Lynch come back to this picture?
No, Stan didn't survive that one. Stan and everyone was pissed at him by the end of the weekend. They played two shows over two nights, and everyone, the whole band, was mad at him.
Man,
he was just such a horse's ass by then. Basically, Tom told his manager, "Fire Stan." Right. He's got to go. And Stan said he knew he needed to go. Stan said he almost made it to where they had to fire him.
Right.
Because he knew Tom would never fire him. He had to become, like, insufferable for Tom to fire him. And so finally they did. Tom fired him. And that was it. So what was interesting is, remember, Stan was just a guy from Gainesville. He's a good drummer. He's a great drummer, but he was a guy, he never had like formal training. He's just a guy from Gainesville who joined a rock band and got pretty good, you know? So they hold auditions for a new drummer, and they eventually get to Steve Ferroni. Mike Campbell had played with Steve Ferroni in a charity show or something. So he brought him in. Steve Ferroni's like a pro. He is like trained professionally. He is a real pro drummer. And I mean, the first song they played with him, they were like, oh my God, what a difference having a drummer makes. And I think that's exactly what Tom said. He said, "What a difference a drummer makes." And
they Stan was like basically his high school mate, more or less, right?
Yeah, they're just buddies.
That's different than a serious, like, studio, internationally renowned kind of person, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So they bring in Steve Ferroni to do some sessions for Wildflowers. They all love him right away. They get along great. He's a cool dude. He's a session drummer, though. I mean, he's flying all over the country doing sessions for people every day.
Sure.
That's his gig.
Right.
So during this time, then Petty gets invited on to SNL right after Wildflowers comes out. Steve Ferroni is booked doing something else that night.
Okay. What year is this?
94,
95. Okay. I just wanted to kind of get that year out there. I have a feeling I know where the story's going.
Kurt Cobain had recently passed away.
Right.
Dave Grohl had yet to start the Foo Fighters.
Right.
I don't know if they'd ever had contact before. I don't know how this exactly came to pass.
I was recently audiobook reading Dave Grohl's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Which I will mention, unfortunately, is narrated by Dave Grohl. So if you're not a fan of him, I don't know why I'm doing this to myself. But I thought, what better way to see if I really do like audiobooks than to torture myself? But it sounded like on that, if I'm remembering correctly, it was like pretty much out of the blue. Like, huge fan, you know. But it was not something where he had, you know, ever talked to him before or anything. It was crazy, kind of a mind blowing. Like, what me?
Right.
You know, like, for real.
I heard him say one time, like, he was like, why don't they want a good drummer? Like, they could get anybody. Why do they want me?
Right.
That's funny. But it's so cool. You can find it on YouTube. They play "You Don't Know How It Feels," which is not much of a, you know, there's not no heavy drums on that.
That's true.
But then they play "Honeybee."
Okay.
And Honeybee, Dave Grohl is just being Dave Grohl. I mean, he's just going nuts on the drums, and it is awesome.
Oh, he actually did it.
Yeah.
You know what? I think that you might have mentioned to me once before that they also offered him like a permanent spot, and that's what he turned down.
I don't know if they officially offered it. In Petty's book, they just say that they knew that Grohl had something else he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Or something else he needed to
do. I mean, it's like half their goddamn age, too, right?
Grohl had already written these songs, and, like, I don't think he wanted to go back into a band situation.
Right.
You know, or a band that he wasn't, you know, in charge of and the front man for.
Right.
So, Grohl does that. It's fun to watch. You should look it up on YouTube. The next night, they play Letterman, or two nights later, they play Dave Letterman. That is Steve Ferroni's first show with the Heartbreakers, and they, like that night, asked him if he would go on tour with them, and he accepted, and he was the drummer up until the very end.
Up until 2017?
Yep.
Really?
Yep, okay. Up until Petty died.
Okay.
He was a part of the band. They still called him the new guy up until the very end. He has a show on
Jason Newsted energy there.
Yes. Damn. He has a show on XM Radio, on Tom's XM Radio station, called The New Guy Show. So, you know, the record to me it's my favorite Petty album, like, no doubt.
Definitely. I've listened through all of them up until this point in the podcast, what we've covered. And yeah, I still strongly agree.
Yeah. It was Petty's favorite.
It's a bold fucking record, man. I mean, for
really
a person
is.
Who's, you know, basically top 40 kind of stuff, you know, it's rock, but, you know,
and a very private guy.
He is
not a tabloid guy. He's not a guy who puts his business out on the street ever. He hated that stuff.
Right.
And for him to be this, like, blatantly open about how he's feeling and what's happening was incredible. But he would tell you that it was an accident. He wasn't trying to write that. And he wasn't even admitting to himself that it was about him. It was like he was writing for a character, but the character was very clearly him.
Yeah, that's the way writing always goes, right?
I guess. I've never written before in my life, but yes, I suppose it does. I'm not an accomplished author like
some people,
my co-host.
Yeah, me neither.
Here.
But maybe someday.
Oh, okay. So I he did another album after this called Echo, which also is very much a divorce album, and we'll talk about that. It's also very sad, but it's not nearly as good.
And is that one is that with the Heartbreakers at that point, or?
Yeah. Okay. That's with the Heartbreakers again. But Wildflowers, when it comes out, it's immediately a hit. The tour is called the Dogs with Wings Tour. It is one of his biggest tours, one of his best tours. By all accounts, it was very fun. The Heartbreakers, always, whenever there was tension within the band, they all say as soon as they hit the road, everything was good. And they all got along, and it was always good to just get on the road.
Yeah.
And Wildflowers was not easy on the band. Petty had already made another solo record. He'd been doing the Traveling Wilburys stuff. Like, they were all worried that he was going to break the band up. They were really worried about it.
What was the frequency? Like, how much distance do we have time-wise between this one and the last solo record? Was this, like, kind of becoming a thing, or is it...
Yeah, so the last solo record was 1990, Full Moon Fever.
Man, so yeah, we are getting to the, like, okay, what's going on here, Tom?
And so, and then he made Into the Great Wide Open, which is a Heartbreakers record, but it was with Jeff Lynne, and I think they were a little threatened by Jeff Lynne, because he had a lot of say, and he really had Tom's ear.
Okay, so yeah, shit really was changing in the band, it seemed like, for the long term.
Yes, yeah. And that was one of Stan Lynch's complaints. Was Tom confronted him about the statement of, you know, the Heartbreakers aren't really my main thing. And Stan Lynch was like, what am I supposed to say? Like, we haven't toured.
That dude's headstone is going to have that written on it.
I'll get that tattooed. That's what I'll get
That's
tattooed.
That's the tattoo. Forget the
Heartbreakers
lyric.
Aren't really my main thing.
I'm sorry.
You
anyway.
Know, but he's like, they wouldn't, he's like, well, what am I supposed to say when I don't hear from you for 2 years?
Yeah.
And, yeah. you know, we don't tour for 2 years. And like, what am I supposed to do to fill my time? Just right. Nothing.
Right.
And I kind of get that. Although I say it's not Tom's responsibility to keep those guys employed 24/7.
Sure.
You know, he can choose to do that. But he doesn't have to.
Yeah. There was a period for Nine Inch Nails where they had, several years off, and there was like a pissy interview where it was the guitarist that would be the touring guitarist got pulled into Axl Rose's Chinese Democracy thing for a couple of years, and Trent Reznor said, like, look, dude, I can't afford paying someone six figures a year just to sit around while, you know, I'm working out what I'm going to do. I was like, damn, like, that's quite the fucking retainer. And obviously Chinese Democracy had a budget different than a lot of projects, and, you know, a very storied a decade long process, sort of, you know, on and off.
Genius takes time.
Jason. Genius takes time.
Just can't rush it. Okay.
Yeah, but I was talking about Chinese Democracy.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
But anyway, I get that. Although, I mean, I do recognize, I don't know. It is what it is, right? We were just now, before we started recording, talking about the recent Blink 182 reunion thing, right? Where it's like, those guys had the same exact thing, where one of them, you know, they've all made plenty of money. One of them has some kids and is like, I'd rather kind of, you know, be the family man and actually see my kids. And some of the other ones don't. Right. And they're like, we want to keep going. And that causes a rift, and different projects wind up spawning out of it for different people because they don't want to. Some of them don't want to tour all of the fucking time. And the other ones, like, they want to keep making money. And to do that, you tour all the time. Right.
Well, and that's why, like, John Bon Jovi says, and Bon Jovi, like, he decides when they tour.
Right.
He and he alone, because he said, I can't have the bass player's wife telling me when to go on tour.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it just can't work like that.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to go when we go.
Right.
And you have to be ready to go.
Yeah. I've heard. And meanwhile, he's got everybody by the throat in terms of, you know, what their income is like. You know what I mean?
Like the big acts, I've heard that, like, McCartney pays his band basically $1 million a year just to be on full time retainer.
Right.
You know,
which is a rounding error of the amount of money McCartney's making a year. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He makes however much he wants to make.
Right.
is the answer.
Yeah.
So, you know, those that level, they can do that.
Sure.
Bob Seger, he said in the mid-80s, he knew he wasn't going to tour for probably a decade. And he told the band before that last tour, I'm paying you all a lot more than I usually would. Save it, because we're not doing this again for a few years.
Yeah.
I think that's the way you handle it.
Yeah.
The last project before it happens, you got to let the band know, we're just going to step away for a little bit. So everyone, you know, save your dollars on this one.
Huh. So, I mean, this sounds like it was, you know, we're obviously going to cover more stuff in the next episode, but it sounds like Wildflowers is, you know, the second or third entry in a series of, like, probably the band for, in a series of probably the band wondering, like, what the fuck is this? Is this done? Are we winding down? You know?
Oh yeah. Ben Montench said he was worried that Tom was just kind of going to go off with Mike Campbell and just, you know, make a new band or something.
Right.
They were all really worried about that. Ben Montench, his big problem was with Jeff Lynne, because he said, if I wasn't at the studio and Jeff Lynne wanted a keyboard part, well, Jeff Lynne would just play it.
Right. Yeah.
So he's like, he said, there was one album, I forgot which one it was, and he said, I'm on it very little.
Yeah.
Because if Jeff wanted something, you know, Jeff can play the keyboard just fine. So if Jeff wanted something, Jeff would just do it.
Right.
And wouldn't call me in to do what he could just do himself.
Right.
So that 1990 to around 1995, 96 was a very difficult period for the Heartbreakers. And they all admittedly were very threatened by what was happening.
Right.
And were worried that he was going to just break the band up and go his own way. You know, one thing that I think was in their minds, I bet, was that Bruce Springsteen did that with the E Street Band in 1990 or so. He broke them up. He just said, see you later, guys. We're done. He paid them all like $1 million.
Sure.
Like just as a parting gift.
Sure.
And he went and got, like, he auditioned just a whole new band. He went to Los Angeles and got whoever he wanted.
What?
For a whole new band. And did that. He played like with those guys for a couple of tours while the E Street Band is just sitting at home.
Huh.
Doing nothing. You know, Max Weinberg is working for Conan O'Brien.
Right.
Because Bruce has a new drummer.
Man.
And then, you know, later on he broke. But during that time, like, the E Street Band had just broken up while this is happening with Petty and the Heartbreakers. And they're pretty similar situations.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that wasn't in the back of their
mind. Well, I mean, like, also, you know, I mean, 1993, 91, 92. You know, the whole alternative thing has, like, flipped over rock and roll. Legacy bands are, you know, they're smoke, right? I mean, they're gone.
Yeah.
Various ones obviously had, like, you know, whatever, faded out in their own ways.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, it seems like it was a tough time anyway. I don't doubt that, like, they weren't having a hard time selling tickets during that era, right, when they did go on tour.
No, not at all.
Right.
They were always a very big draw, because during this time, even regardless of how they were feeling,
right,
they were having hits. Full Moon Fever was full of hits.
Yeah.
Into the Great Wide Open had two or three hits.
Right, yeah.
And that's considered, like, one of his, you know, fewer hit albums.
Right, yeah.
And so, no, they're having success. They're just not really vibing with each other at the moment is really what's happening. Until they go on the Wildflowers tour, at which point it's all good.
Right.
They get on the road and everyone's happy again.
Hmm.
And it's great. And now they're on the road with Steve Ferroni instead of Stan Lynch. Stan Lynch is gone. Stan Lynch is really candid in the Tom Petty book. He talks. And, you know, he's still a little defensive about it to this day. He's still kind of defensive about the whole thing. He said he kind of regrets the way it ended, but he said whenever he goes over it in his head, he's like, what else could I have done?
Right.
And he doesn't really have a good answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, you can only put everything on pause at random at somebody else's whim for so long. You know what I mean?
Oh, I remember a couple of years ago, a little bit of Matchbox 20 trivia.
Yep.
When their guitar player, like, issued a statement saying, I'm quitting Matchbox 20 after, you know, however many years. I just can't live my life year to year waiting for Rob to decide when we're going to tour.
Right.
And, you know, we said we were going to go last year. He canceled. Said we were going to go this year. He canceled. I just can't do this anymore. I'm leaving the band.
Right.
And then the next year, they announced the tour, and he was back.
Yeah. Well, you know, a paycheck is a paycheck, right?
You know, and I for that level, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a good paycheck when you have it, but it's
probably not. And you've been to that example before where it's like, what are you going to do? Go be a Matchbox 20 cover band locally or something at best? I mean, you're, you know,
it's the best job you're going to get.
Yeah, exactly. Like
by far.
Right. Unless Tom Petty's looking for a guitarist, I guess. I don't know. I mean, but, you know, I just feel like there are certain titans of rock that are on the magazines and have been for decades that people, that big bands go knocking for, right? I don't know. I feel like Metallica might be the exception where it's like, what was he from? Was it like Suicidal Tendencies or something was the band? Which was, it was a revered band for sure. Like, high praise for his musical chops and his ability to play. But a lot of times, like the guys you that like you mentioned in for the Wildflowers, where it's like it's some studio musician who's toured with, you know, legacy bands already, you know, and
and like Steve and I never saw Stan Lynch live. I actually did recently when with he played with Mike Campbell, and Mike Campbell was doing a tour.
Okay.
Last year. So that was fun, but I'd never saw Stan Lynch with Petty.
Okay.
But I've seen a lot of video and whatnot, and I've you know, heard the records. There's definitely a different sound, and I kind of do prefer the sound of Stan Lynch. I prefer kind of the more...
kind of like a little bit of a signature, you know, I mean, some of these guitarists, like you can not even know, but you can tell Mark Knopfler's on a track, you know?
It sounds, Stan sounds like he's playing in a garage.
Huh.
And Steve Ferroni sounds like he's playing in a studio.
Yeah, even just live.
It's just a feel. Even live.
Yeah,
Steve Ferroni is technically perfect. I mean, he is a great drummer.
Right.
But there is just something different about the guy from Gainesville who's just kind of wailing on the drums.
Man, that's kind of like the whole Echoes thing in the Momentary Lapse tour, where Gilmore was like, he got these studio musicians, and he was like, Echoes is kind of a feeling it vibe kind of deal, and these guys can't like get off the click track, you know, they can't just fall apart, I think was the quote. And, yeah, I feel that, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, and he sounds a little regretful these days, but you know, like I said, he doesn't seem to have a good answer as to what he would have done differently.
Right.
So it is what it is. He did see them again at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
Okay.
When they got inducted, and even then there was a little bit of friction because I guess he came out. He lived in Florida. He lived back in Gainesville at this point. He came out to California to rehearse with them because they're going to do a couple of songs.
Okay.
And so they fly him out. He rehearses, and then like the Heartbreakers all fly on their private jet to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, while Stan Lynch somehow was like on his own to get there.
Man,
and he brings this up in the book. He talks about this like he couldn't believe that like they didn't let him fly on their jet.
Right.
And Petty, the one stipulation on this book was that he could respond to anything that he thought needed to be responded to.
Okay.
The writer didn't have to put it in the book. He just wanted to be able to respond to whatever anyone said.
Sure.
So in this case, he responded and he said, hand to God, if I had known Stan wanted to fly with us, he would have flown with us. He said, I thought he was like flying back to Florida and then going to New York from there.
Right.
He said, I had no idea. We wouldn't have kept him off the plane. Yeah. So, I think this is a thing where Stan likes to kind of get defensive over things sometimes.
Sure.
And I think that's what's happened here.
Sort of proxy feelings getting hurt for other bigger reasons.
Yeah.
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 So they go on tour. Like you said, it sounds like the band's back together, so to speak. Things are gelling and stuff. We're obviously going to cover more stuff in the next episode, but like, what is this period like? First of all, divorce actually happens after this record is released.
After the tour.
He plays this record for his wife and his kids. Goes on tour. I'm just trying to get the timeline right.
Yes,
which presumably was more than like a 1 month tour. And then comes back and basically finalizes it.
It's a very long tour.
Oh, man.
Comes back and he tells his wife that it's over.
She's like, really? Oh, my God. I'm so surprised.
Yeah, I have to say, I said earlier there was some mental illness there, and I think that's apparent.
Yeah.
He does. He tells his wife he's leaving her. It really is very painful for him. Yeah. He's very concerned about his kids. Because
they were like high school sweethearts, right? I mean, it was from the beginning through everything, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. He moves to they call it the chicken shack. It's like a little house in the woods, like a cabin. Literally on like a chicken farm. Sounds like where you live. And
it doesn't sound too bad to me, but okay.
Yeah. And so he goes out there and the album is over, the tour is over, he's left his wife, and he falls into a deep, deep, deep depression.
Okay.
To the point where he starts using heroin.
Oh shit. And he's been, aside from maybe like beer and smoking weed, he's not that guy up until
this point. Maybe a little coke, but back then I think everyone was.
Yeah, sure.
But otherwise was not like a big drug guy at all.
Interesting.
Stevie Nicks said when she found out, she was floored because she said, I never in a million years would have thought he would have been the guy.
Yeah.
Just didn't seem like him.
Okay.
And they asked the guy who wrote the book, he did an interview on a radio station here in Dallas, and they asked him like, who's giving Petty heroin?
Right.
And he's like, you know, in that world, everyone just knows someone.
Yeah.
Like it's just around.
Right.
It's, you'd be shocked how easy it is to get literally anything.
Yeah.
In that world, because there are people who will do anything for you.
Yeah, exactly. Sycophants abound, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He moves into this house in the woods. He has no idea how to take care of himself. Stevie Nicks said he did not know how to go grocery shopping. He did not know, like, what food he needed to buy.
So Tom fucking Petty, multi-millionaire, has teenage kids at this point. They're teenagers, yes. Right?
Yeah, yes.
Is, like, probably living in squalor?
It's not squalor. I suspect if I ever found pictures of this place, it's a lot nicer than they're making it sound.
Okay, this is not a John Frusciante Odyssey for several years, just like sleeping on a mattress with needles all over the floor.
But I do think it was small. I think it was like a 2-bedroom thing. I mean, it was like a small,
right,
like log cabin in the woods,
right?
Basically, but
I think the deciding factor is the answer to this question: piss jugs or no piss jugs?
Piss jugs, but for fun.
Oh, okay, okay,
yeah.
As long as it's on the up and up.
Yeah,
right.
Because you want him.
John Frusciante, when he went off in his little odyssey, he literally made a couple of, like, I think really half-assed solo records. I've not listened to them, but he was extremely upfront with, like, interviews about them. That was, like, literally just to try and, you know, be able to skate for a couple more years and feed his heroin habit. It was,
wow,
you know,
yeah,
not good shape. A lot of people were very surprised he, you know, was still alive, you know. At various points during that little hiatus he was on.
Interesting.
Is this just kind of a lost chapter, or like how does he get out of this?
Well, he a couple of things happen. One of the problems that they identified in the book was that the boundaries he had set with the Heartbreakers kind of made it difficult for them to help him. Because they didn't have that kind of relationship by then. They were all kind of at arm's length a little bit. And so, like Mike Campbell has said, like, looking back now, I wish you would have been able to just tell me, like, this is what's happening.
Right.
And, you know, this is really painful. And but we never talked like that.
Yeah. It was business at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of was.
Huh.
But he does meet a woman that he met backstage at a show a couple of years before. And then he like had run into her a couple of times. He runs into her at a Johnny Cash show and they talk for the first time and they're both single. And like, he just is smitten with her right away. This is the woman he ends up marrying and would be married to for the rest of his life.
Okay.
This is Dana.
That'll do it. Love will pull you out of it sometimes.
Well, and she didn't know that he was using heroin, but he invited her out to the chicken shack. And I guess, you know, apparently it just becomes apparent.
Put the piss jugs in the closet, the coke closet.
But what's funny is, like, she has a little kid at home, and so, like, she can only come out, like, every other weekend. And so it's, like, I just laugh when I think about Tom Petty having to adhere to someone else's, like, child custody schedule.
Right.
I don't know why that strikes me as funny, but it is.
Man.
But she definitely, her and Stevie Nicks, like, basically, like, pull him out of it.
Right.
Like, her and Stevie Nicks, like, care for him. And, like, and Petty knew, too, that he couldn't, like, do it. He wasn't, I don't think he fought getting help.
Right.
Like, he knew it wasn't something he could continue to do.
Okay. So he's responsible at his core, you know.
Yes.
It's yes. Just, you know. I don't know. You know, I had a friend who went through a divorce, and one of his things was, like, he was like, yeah, man, she left behind several cases of wine. And yeah, he just fucking, and he was not a drinker. He just went through it in like 2 months. It was aggressive,
wow.
To say yeah. the least. And it was like, I mean, fuck, if you're going to have a bender, when's the time to do it? I don't know about a heroin bender, not necessarily recommending that, but
right.
You know, I could see that being, you know, a time in the life where that would happen if somebody's going to have that chapter.
Right? It would be at your loneliest moment.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's quite lonely. His kids have kind of turned on him. They kind of view this as his fault.
after the reveal, probably, hopefully, yeah. talked about at that moment. And then, hey, I'm going on tour, but, you know, we're not divorced.
Right. They like, the older daughter by this time actually was in college already. But the younger one was like 13 or 14. And like... She lived with him for like a month, and he could not take care of her.
Oh, man.
He was incapable. And so she ended up moving.
It was like, it was a, you know, it sounded like you said that the ex-wife had like addiction problems and some mental illness problems too, but she was,
yes,
she was the mom. She would stay home and, you know.
Right. But it sounds like, I don't know that she was capable of taking care of her daughter at this point either.
Okay.
Huh. And so the daughter ends up going to live with her older sister. And like the older sister, Adria, has said, like, that caused a lot of problems between us, between me and my dad, because I was raising my sister.
Yeah, that's fucked
and,
up.
And my dad couldn't.
Right.
And like that caused a lot of problems for a long time. And then they came to believe that this new woman, Dana, that like that's why Tom left their mom, which it wasn't.
Right.
But that became something that they became convinced of at some point.
Right.
And it's just a mess. His life is just a mess.
Right.
But he
guess money doesn't solve all. Right. And yeah,
he does get some help. He does get cleaned up. He does one project during this time, which is the soundtrack to the movie She's the One.
Okay. Which it has some of the outtakes from Wildflower Sessions, right? Or no?
It does. Okay. It has some outtakes. Some of the stuff that didn't get on Wildflowers ended up on that record.
Have you heard this record? Because like, there's been... I'm always weary of these things because it's either the guy chooses a lot of tracks from other bands and so it's fine. It's like a mix of other bands, or it's like, I'm going to try and do instrumental stuff and here's some orchestral stuff that's just Tom Petty made it. But
no, it's a collection of songs.
Okay.
It's a collection of actual songs.
Okay.
And
good companion to Wildflowers up until this new, you know, all the rest thing came out or nah?
It has a couple of songs I really love, like Angel Dream. You know, there's like a collaboration with Lindsey Buckingham.
Oh man.
So there's a couple of interesting things on it,
sure.
But it doesn't have a big hit.
Okay.
It was his lowest selling album at some point. I'm sure he had some lower ones later on because people quit buying albums. But,
okay.
You know, it was a thud. I don't think it was real well reviewed. I don't mind it. I like it, but definitely not his best work. And he said, like, he was trying to keep busy.
Right.
He was trying to do something. And that's why he did it, because he was bored. And he wasn't in a good headspace at all. And so,
yeah.
You know, so that was it.
Okay. So that's kind of that's pretty much the Wildflowers chapter, though. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, kind of this arc where he's, in a weird way, letting everybody know he's getting divorced, and then sort of a deep depression, and you know, kicking out this soundtrack. Sounds like
the last,
and like you said, love and some friends sort of do pull him out of it after a little while. Is this a multi-year kind of problem, or?
Yeah, I think the heroin use was pretty short term.
Okay.
But I think there was a deep depression there for like 2 full years.
Okay.
From about 96 to 98 or so.
Okay. So he didn't disappear off the map for half a decade or anything.
No, no. He got some help and he pulled himself out of it and he kept working.
Yeah.
And he would tell you that those two albums, the She's the One soundtrack and then the next one, Echoes, Echo, are albums that he just shouldn't have made.
Right.
Like he was not ready to make it a record. But he did. And, you know, there's some good stuff on both of those. We'll talk about that next time and kind of what he does to end, you know, end his, the last stage of his career.
Yeah.
But, okay. You know, the last thing that happens with Wildflowers is last year they put out this, Wildflowers and All the Rest, which is all the songs that didn't get on Wildflowers.
Right.
They are some great songs that easily could have been on Wildflowers.
Right.
They really fit. They have the same mood, the same sound. And then they do this Wildflowers documentary where there were cameras filming the recording process of this album.
Yeah. And, it's basically found footage in 2020 from 1990, whatever, mid-90s when they were recording it.
It's really, really interesting. I mean, just from a perspective of just seeing how a record is made in general, it's really interesting. And just to see kind of how Petty is at the time is just really fascinating. So really, really highly recommend. It's free. It's definitely on YouTube.
And one of the benefits of that 2020 release as well is that it had a, you know, had a multitude of releases, a sort of 5-CD thing where you can get all kinds of, you know, demo versions of songs, the, you know, All the Rest thing and so on the various CDs. But in particular, the vinyl release, they have a version that's just Wildflowers by itself. And before that came out, the Wildflowers vinyl was, of course, very rare, coming out in the early 90s. You know, I mean, it wasn't zero vinyl sales, but that was a, you know, $500 record until that came out. So, and the remaster sounds incredible and stuff. So, if you've love that record for a long, long time and ever seen the price, I'm like, well, I guess I'll never own that. It's out there and affordable now and super high quality. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Before we go, you know, for me, I got into this because you told me about it. You know, I was going through a divorce and you're kind of like, you know, hey, this is, you know, maybe relatable to you. Like, how did you figure this out? Was this something that like in the late 90s you somehow came across it? What is the story of you figuring out that, you know, Wildflowers is the best record of all time?
I probably not until a few years ago. I'm trying to think of what made me listen to it all the way through for the first time.
Was that just a few years before you told me, like 2015, 2016?
Yeah, it would have been around that time.
Oh, okay.
That I kind of stumbled to, you know, I knew a lot of the songs, but I never listened to it all the way through. And then you do find those hidden gems like Crawling Back to You.
Yeah.
So once I kind of listened to it all the way through once, then I did it a bunch of times. I mean, I just did it over and over and over
same,
again.
Definitely. It's one of those records for sure where you're like, man, this is a mood. It's so consistent. Yeah. It's so great.
All the way through.
Yeah.
There is not a song on that record I want to skip.
Right. Exactly.
It's perfect.
I got to listen to this All the Rest thing because like they said, they had like 30 tracks or something. And I think 15 or so, right, are on the Wildflowers record. There's 10 that are on the All the Rest thing. I guess another several of them went to the She's the One. But I feel like when I looked at the Wildflowers Wikipedia, it seems like I think that All the Rest has even the ones that are on the She's the One soundtrack and such, but
it might. I don't remember. I listened to it when it first came out a couple of times. I don't know that I've given it a good listen since then.
Sure.
So yeah, it very well may have some of those also. There's some great stuff. Angel Dream is one of his best songs. I mean, that's a great song.
Yeah.
You know, again, not his most heralded work.
Sure.
Not by any means. So
cool.
But yeah, man, Wildflowers.
Wildflowers.
Great stuff.
Great fucking record.
Yep.
Cool. All right. See you guys next time.
All right.